This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello.
And welcome to Plotting Through the President. I'm Howard Dory.
I'm Jess Dory.
And we've got a very exciting interview to share with you today.
Ooh.
We have been talking about Apple's new miniseries, Franklin, about Benjamin Franklin for a while.
Oh my gosh, it's so good.
Yes, and it's finally out. We've seen the first three episodes.
Yes.
I had the pleasure of talking to Franklin producer and screenwriter Kirk Ellis.
Oh, wow.
He also wrote the screenplay for HBO's John Adams miniseries.
I heard this interview went really well. I cannot wait to hear it.
Yeah, I talked to him about all kinds of things about the Franklin series and its rich characters and settings, what Michael Douglas brings to the role, and what it was like adapting David McCullough's book, John Adams, and Stacey Schiff's book, A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America. And we also talked about what scenes he disagreed with the authors about in the adaptations.
Wow.
So I hope you enjoy. Emmy and Peabody Award-winning writer and producer Kirk Ellis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Howard. It's a pleasure to be plotting through presidents with you.
I appreciate that. And I'm so excited to talk to you because you clearly have a passion for bringing historic stories to life. And I wanted to ask you, where does that come from?
Well, I suppose there's two answers to that. I've always been interested in history and in learning about, you know, the manners and personalities and thoughts of people who walked before us. But on an industry level, as a writer, you're often typecast the same way actors are. So my initial success came through a series of biographical or true life dramas that were done for, believe it or not, for ABC back in the time when the networks were still into this sort of long form programming. And so that got me typed as the historical guy. So I've written in virtually every genre but science fiction and musicals, but the projects for which people think of me all tend to be these historical dramas.
Now, is it fair to say that your interest in history started with the American West?
That's fair. I mean, I grew up as a child of the border in El Paso, Texas. And my family traveled around a lot, but I went to elementary school there, and I learned Spanish and English pretty much simultaneously. So I got to know the history of the American West, and particularly the American Southwest, the Spanish, Hispanic, and Native American histories, the Aboriginal histories. So that was always a passion of mine. I thought I was going to move into something like archaeology or anthropology, but as I went through elementary school and then ultimately junior high and high school, I became very interested in writing and journalism. I had a wonderfully inspiring professor my senior year of advanced placement English, a guy named Spencer Beasley, who was a big Faulknerian, really introduced me to a lot of the great 19th and 20th century novelists, Dostoevsky, Faulkner, Hemingway, etc., and really thought I should pursue a career in writing. And for a while, that was journalism, which became a wonderful training ground. This is back in the days of print journalism. I was working at the Hollywood Reporter and the LA Times, and then ultimately spent a couple of years in England as the editor of a motion picture and television industry trade magazine. But, you know, you learned how to construct stories in very economical ways, but you also learned about how to attack a narrative from a variety of points of view. And that's what I do really as a screenwriter, whether you're writing about, you know, I've written about, for instance, John Adams twice, once in the John Adams Show, where he's the main character, and then here in the new Franklin miniseries for Apple, where he's the antagonist. And they're two very different points of view. So you learn as a journalist how to take all these different and often competing agendas and structure them in a way that gets at some objective truth.
Yeah, that's something that I wanted to jump in a little bit because
sure.
What was it like having John Adams kind of in your head, writing in his voice, and you were writing Franklin from Adams's point of view as well at that time?
That's right. That point for the HBO miniseries, that's true. Yes.
That really sort of flipped. Did you look at John Adams differently after doing that? And what was that like?
Well, sure. So luckily, there were many years intervening. It wasn't like I immediately went from the John Adams show and like, oh, let's turn the character 180 degrees around and write him this way. That wasn't. A lot of other projects intervened. But there was always the fact that when we were making John Adams, we were doing it. It was David McCullough's book, and we were adopting his point of view, which was a rose-colored portrait in many ways of one of our founding fathers. And David and I didn't always agree on certain things about the character, but one thing that we were steadfast about was that we would see the experiences Adams lived through and the people he met through his very specific lens. And we certainly knew what he thought about people because he left extensive letters and diary entries. Adams was one of those rare individuals who literally documented everything he thought or said. So there was a tremendous treasure trove of firsthand material. And even at the time of writing that, there were other books coming out about that era, most notably Walter Isaacson's book on Benjamin Franklin. Mm. And so it came out, and I went to the bookstore to look at it. This is 2005, 2006. And I thumbed through the index and went to the first entry for John Adams. And it said something like, in his usual irritating way, comma, John Adams, dot, dot, dot. And I closed the book and never went back to it because that was an alternative point of view. But it was inescapable in doing this story of Franklin's 8 years in Paris that John Adams was going to appear. So I had to do what I did for Franklin in the John Adams show in reverse. I had to use Franklin's point of view of John Adams. And you haven't seen him yet in the first three episodes.
No, I can't wait.
He doesn't make his appearance until very near the end of episode four. You'll be very amused by that sort of introduction. And at that point, I knew it was going to become this good cop, bad cop kind of thing, which is really what they adopted in their approach to the French court. But there's a much pricklier John Adams in this show.
Okay, yeah, really looking forward to that, because we did an episode kind of exploring why Franklin and Adams. Loathe is a strong word, but...
Well, absolutely. You know, they were, loathing is not too strong a word. Okay. I mean, they were frenemies, you know, and there was a lot of bad blood between them that never really healed in many ways. I mean, even when Franklin died and had the largest funeral America had ever seen in Philadelphia, Adams had nothing good to say about him. So it was, he could hold a grudge beyond the grave.
That's one thing I love about Adams, and that's true of Adams' relationship with Hamilton as well. Even Washington. Right. Adams did not respect the dead. And that's one thing to love about his letters and his feelings.
Right. So, I mean, both of the characterizations are true to Adams. The one in the show that bears his name and the one in Franklin, they're just different sides of a very, very complex personality.
Looking back at both John Adams and Benjamin Franklin, is there one character that you might gravitate more toward?
Well, I mean, if you're good at what you do as a screenwriter, you're tending to identify very intensely with the person you're writing about at the time. So I certainly believe that Franklin is the more accessible of the two characters. To use that hackneyed phrase, he's the founding father you'd most want to have a beer with, certainly. Although, unlike Adams, we don't know what Franklin was thinking at the time he was in France. He left, you know, his autobiography, which is considered a classic of American literature, reveals absolutely nothing about him that's that deep. And so even his writings, such as they are in France, we don't get any description of what it was like to go to the opera, what it was like to walk the halls of Versailles, what it was like to speak to the Comte de Vergennes. We don't have any of that. We just know the basic facts. But Franklin clearly had a very active inner life, but he left no record of that. So in a way, this was a more difficult effort to get into the essence of the man because he left so little of himself in his personal writing.
From the first few episodes, there are a couple of historical characters that really stood out to me as fascinating characters that I'm enjoying seeing portrayed. The first one is Temple Franklin, someone I don't think we've ever really seen portrayed on screen before. And I'm curious how you saw that character? As was that a surrogate for the audience to kind of see France through these young eyes, or?
Sure. So just to do the sort of historical contextualization, William Temple Franklin was the bastard son of Franklin's own bastard son, William Franklin, who was the colonial governor of New Jersey, who at the time of the story was actually a prisoner of the Continental Congress because he had refused to swear allegiance to the, quote, new government and was considered an enemy of the state. And Franklin essentially kidnapped Temple, picked him up and said, I'm taking him to Philadelphia for his education, and then pretty much got on a boat to France. And Temple was there for the whole stay. And so there was an opportunity here to do a transgenerational story. The story isn't only Franklin's machinations and his seduction of the French court and many of his closest colleagues. It's also the story of this young man who is a bit of a blank slate, coming to Paris and being seduced the other way, becoming more and more French as Franklin becomes more assuredly American. So in that sense, yes, Temple is meant to be a bit of an audience surrogate, especially for this new generation of viewers, who we hope to obtain, who don't maybe know Franklin's story well. And that's the other thing. Until Stacey Schiff resurrected this story in her book, A Great Improvisation, what people knew and what people continue to know about Benjamin Franklin is electricity, the kite, invention. But all of that precedes this. And really, this is the core to who Franklin was. He invented the American persona, how Americans were perceived in Europe, and even how we perceive ourselves today, whether we're talking about MAGA, the Tea Party, this sort of, rustic who isn't part of the elite. But he also invented the notion of America. So this is really the fundamental part of both Franklin's life and our origin story. So that's a long answer to who Temple was. Temple's record historically is very, very thin, especially in this period. We have occasional letters to and from the Marquis de Lafayette, to and from Jacques Leray de Chaumont, who was the, as you know from the show, is the sort of ne'er-do-well son of Franklin's hosts in Paris. So we were able to build Temple's story from these stepping stones, this handful of stepping stones of facts, but to create it in a way that had some contemporary relevance.
You mentioned Stacey Schiff's work, A Great Improvisation. As a writer, how do you take a work like that? How do you tackle that? And what's your approach to bringing that to the screen?
Well, I should say that I was already familiar with Stacey's book, doing the research and writing for John Adams, because the book came out in 2005, which coincided nicely with the beginning of my work on that show. In terms of getting things from outline in the script form. And the book became invaluable for this portrait of Franklin and Adams, particularly in episode 3 of the John Adams show for HBO, which was all about their work in France and their rivalry. So I had gone through the book and I'd read it thoroughly. I'm very research and structure based. So I spend a great deal of time with, if there's original manuscripts, original writings, all of that, starting with that, then moving into the secondary and tertiary histories. And I use post-it notes. I take a lot of notes, but I literally post-it note pages of the book with different colors, whether they're talking about John Adams or Benjamin Franklin or Abigail Adams or Madame Brion or their scene setters and those kinds of things. And I still had Stacey's book when the call came to adapt this, with all the post-it notes still in place. So I could reread it a couple of times, but I sort of knew what I was going to extract. And with anything, whether it's John Adams or Anne Frank, who I also did a two-part miniseries about, or the Beach Boys, or Judy Garland, and all the other things that haven't been produced, you have a massive amount of material, but you have to focus it. Now, Stacey's book was already really focused because it was only about Franklin's years in Paris. So right there, she had done a lot of editing that I would normally have to do on a subject this large. But even within that, there were characters who had to fall by the wayside. Franklin wasn't the only ambassador to Paris. There were two other Americans there, Silas Deane and Arthur Lee. He actually brought two grandsons with him. But Temple stayed with him in Paris. He put the other one in a boarding school and never really saw him for much of that journey. So you're always making these compressions. And people always ask, how did you know what to include in the story? And that's not the right question. The right question is, how did you know what to exclude from the story? So these are really things that take place from Franklin or Temple's point of view for the main of the story. We have certain French characters who we spend some time with because their machinations are important to how the Franklin story resolves itself. But we really had to extract a core narrative from what Stacy had already unearthed from that massive historical record.
Was there one scene or moment, either in the book or through research, that really kind of made you feel like, oh, I've got it. This is how to crack it. This is how to really think about Franklin.
I've learned over time to really trust you, because I work with book authors a lot. And you have to understand as a screenwriter that they've done a lot of this legwork. All the stuff that you're going to do, look at all the sources they've looked at before, they've done that. So I always pay attention to the opening lines of books, nonfiction books. And Stacy's book began with Franklin and Temple being dumped on that coast of France, hundreds of miles off course, in the middle of the night, with no clear path to Paris. That's a great opening. And it was very much an opening of a noir film and a suspense thriller. So the pitch for the show was always, this is John Adams, the miniseries, meets John le Carré. It's a thriller, in many ways, about a key moment in American history. And so that was the tone that we went through this. But because we're dealing with the French court and the fish-out-of-water story for both Franklin and his grandson Temple, there was a chance to inject this sense of class consciousness and also a good deal of humor into the story. You know, John Adams is a great miniseries, but there aren't a lot of laughs in it. And because we're focused on that intense personality of John Adams, there's a lot of humor in the Franklin show, and there's a lot of lightness of spirit, and that was really great to work on, to do something in a slightly different vein.
Nice. I saw that you mentioned that the Franklin series was a product of intense collaboration.
Yes.
Can you tell me more what that looked like?
Well, sure. I mean, it's, you know, you work as a writer for many, many years. And, you know, one thing that John Adams and Franklin, the shows, have in common is they both took 6 years of my life from conception to premiere. Just kind of odd. And, you know, as you get older, you realize you don't have all that much time. You can't always, you know, spend that much time on something. But you develop it to a point where you're so familiar with the story, you start to lack a certain amount of perspective. And because of the nature of this production, when Apple and Michael Douglas came aboard, what had been stalled previously at other companies, etc., suddenly took on a significant amount of momentum. And it was imperative that other voices be brought in. The first, and in many ways the most important, was that of Tim Van Patten, the director of every episode of the show. And what Tim signed on so that he could really oversee the vision of the entire show rather than set it in a couple of episodes or come in as a guest director as he would have done on Game of Thrones or Boardwalk Empire, the many shows he was in charge of. So Tim could look at it and decide what else he wanted to bring to it. And once he got involved, we really started firing on all cylinders. And then bringing in Howard Korter, who just coincidentally is another writer who lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, my hometown. And Howard and I knew each other, but we hadn't seen each other or worked together in 20 years when he came aboard the project. Howard was able to look at the existing material, the existing scripts, and think about what remained to be written and say, oh, well, you know, this thread is really working really well. This thread's really kind of confusing, or I'm not sure what it contributes to the overall thing. Let's pull that and make room for this. So all of those voices together made for a much richer script on the page. And then when you bring actors in of the likes of Michael Douglas, who had very, very firm ideas about the character, Noah Jupe, the remarkable young actor who was 17 at the time he played Temple Franklin, remarkable young British actor who people know from Quiet Place or Ford versus Ferrari. This is a real transitional part for him. It's got such great range, and Noah brought a lot of his own ideas to that role. And that was true all across the board with the cast. The French cast and the British cast really astounded me and astounded all of us with their level of research before they even walked onto the set. Ludivine Sagnier, who plays Madame Brion, Franklin's neighbor, is very flirty but very sort of high-strung neighbor in Passy, went to the archives, the historical archives in Paris, and read all of her letters to Franklin and Franklin's letters back to her, which are all in French, and came into the first meeting prepared with all of that stuff. So it was really great when you're working with people on that level of professionalism, you're going to listen to their input on things.
So how did Michael Douglas get involved, and what was it like working with him both as a fellow producer and an actor?
Michael and our fellow executive producer, Richard Plepler, who I knew as the boss at HBO when we were doing John Adams, they had obviously gotten together to do a remarkable show about Liberace called Behind the Candelabra. And it was Richard's idea to see if he could entice Michael to do something. And there's always a dance when you're dealing with an actor on that level of career, especially one who's never done period. But Michael took the plunge in a way other actors of his stature and reputation would not have, because Franklin was 70 years old when he went to France. He was very ill for part of that. He almost died on a couple of occasions. There was a real risk that he never was going to come back to America. So he embraced all of that and really looked to find that seductive quality and that slyness and that humor, which are qualities in Franklin that we really haven't seen portrayed before, but he owned all of these. And on a set, there's nothing he really hasn't seen, but he was very much appreciative of the fact that Tim created a no-drama set. The only drama was on screen. This was one of the most, not only collaborative, but just friendly and welcoming and warm productions any of us have been fortunate to be a part of. And I can say this, Michael said it in interview after interview, he calls this the best production he was ever involved with in 40 years.
Wow.
So one has to take that, you know, as a real endorsement of the significant amount of prep work that went in. He said to us, you know, you've got to surround me with the best English and French actors. I don't want people who are putting on phony accents and all of this. And like all of us, he was astounded by their level of quality. I was just reading an interview he gave with Tim Van Patten and Noah Jupe in Variety, where he said one thing he was constantly asking was, does anybody in this cast suck? You put one actor in front of me who's better than the last one. Even the extras and the day players are good. And he was so appreciative of that work that Michael stuck around every day after his scenes were done and his shots were done, so he could deliver off-camera lines to his co-stars, which in France and England, they're not used to doing that. And the actors were so appreciative of the extra step that he took to do that.
Speaking of Michael Douglas and humor, I believe Michael Douglas mentioned that one of the moments early on in the first episode wasn't something that you or Howard Korter wrote. Was it Douglas that said, hey, I think Franklin should fart here?
Oh, yeah, he came up with that.
Yeah.
There was a debate about when it should occur. Okay. Should it occur in the first episode, or should we save it and savor it later? And in the end, that was the decision. The decision was made to do it in the first episode because you want to do that with shows like this. You want to let an audience know that it's okay to have fun. You can laugh. Lines are meant to be funny. Behavior is meant to be funny. The title credits for the show which many people have compared to the opening credits for Monty Python, but which are really based on French engravings and illustrations and even old French theater boxes that you've seen in museums. Those also let the audience know this doesn't have to be this somber affair that's going to be an hour-long history lesson for 8 weeks. No, there's going to be a lot of entertainment value. So yeah, Michael was, I remember, you know, one of the links he sent of things to read was Franklin fart jokes. So
nice. Yeah. I mean, he wrote like a whole essay about
fart proudly. It was called. Yeah.
You know, that's definitely part of Franklin that it's fun to see portrayed for sure.
Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Talking about France, I mean, France is more than just a setting in the show. I mean, it's a character. And the entire series, was that shot in France?
We did. We shot the entire film, including that handful of scenes that take place in America. We shot entirely in France. Both in central Paris, we took over parts of central Paris during July and August when there were fewer people in town and we could spread out a bit, or we were within an hour's drive of the city in any direction. There were a handful of overnight locations in Saint-Malo where we shot the opening scene and the scenes that are meant to take place in Lave, and there were certain chateaus that were just far enough outside the center of town that we needed to house everybody for a couple of nights. But whether or not an audience is aware that the locations are real, they're not sets, they're not purpose-built, they feel it. They feel a kind of tactile energy. This is what Stanley Kubrick did, for instance, famously with Barry Lyndon, even to the point of lighting everything with real candles. And certainly that was on our minds as well, in terms of giving this real, almost breathable sense of the period. And I'm really grateful to hear you say that France is a character, because we wanted it to be, and it was historically for Franklin as well. There were many occasions where we were literally in the same places that Franklin had been for many of the scenes. You will see in episode 4, for instance, when Franklin is finally received at court, he's received in the king's bedchamber. And we shot the scene there, where it actually occurred. And I was told later that we were the first production to ever shoot there, because our show had the benefit of being both not only American patrimony, but French patrimony as well. It wasn't just the backdrop to a big, Versailles wasn't the backdrop to some big action scene in a James Bond film. This was about history that took place there. So we had a few of those advantages.
And one of the things that makes it feel so immersive and authentic is all the French dialogue. You mentioned you speak Spanish. Do you speak French as well?
Well, I taught myself to read French fairly fluently on the set. I had gone to Paris I was up to level 4 of a Pimsleur course. And I got off the plane, and within an hour, I realized that everything I had learned was totally useless. none of it had any application in the real world. So hanging around our mostly young crew and hearing them talk, you know, and using the various slang expressions was tremendously helpful. So I learned to understand it when people spoke it to me, but I'm still really reluctant with my bad accent, which is worse than Franklin's historically, to speak it. But we did have a translator and a dialect coach on set who were working with us, both me and Howard, in those translations, and we would then be able to vet what the French translation said to make sure that the gist of the dialogue was coming through. But from the beginning, this show was designed to be bilingual. We were not going to have French characters speaking with the French accent in English. Just we're past that, I think, as audiences. First, there was the Americans, where when you got into the last few seasons of that show, half the dialogue was in Russian, you know? So we ended up with about a 50-50 English to French value on the show. There are whole sequences and even parts of whole episodes that take place entirely in subtitled French. And we're unapologetic about that.
Yeah.
We created a certain number of French characters for whom it would be plausible that they spoke English, especially the Comte de Vergennes, who was France's top diplomat, who had worked in Constantinople and knew Turkish in the years before this, and who did speak some English. We have Beaumarchais, the playwright, who was also America's first gunrunner, wonderfully played by Assad Bouab from Call My Agent. Beaumarchais had been a special agent of the French crown in England to unmask a spy. We don't know how much English he spoke, but again, it was plausible for him to do so. And we have characters in the show who, when they're with Franklin or with Temple, speak English. But when they're among themselves, they only speak French. And that's as it should be.
Yeah, a couple other characters that I think of. The Marquis de Lafayette, the portrayal is just, it really captures in a way that I don't think a lot of other things do, just how young this guy was and the spirit of it. And there's a mention, just a brief mention of his wife. And I think from reading Sarah Bowell's biography of him, that was the first time I realized that she may have been pregnant when he left.
She was pregnant when he left. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
That's not a side of him you really see.
And he's gone for about 2 years, but he's only 18 years old when he goes over. He's roughly Temple's contemporary, as we show in the program, but they were all young. You know, they were kids, the people who fought the revolution. But Lafayette, again, is a character. It's funny, if you're in America, there are actually more county, cities, schools, public buildings, bridges, roads named after Lafayette than there are after George Washington. Mm. But in France, they know Lafayette from his conduct in the lead up to and during the French Revolution, which was controversial. They don't really know this part of the story, or, you know, how Franklin and Temple were involved in it. So he's great, and he's a wonderful actor, and he's a French-Canadian actor, Theodore Pellerin, who plays him, and he's actually playing Yves Saint Laurent in a new series about Karl Lagerfeld.
Oh, cool.
As well. So, no, Theodore was absolutely terrific, and he really got the spirit of Lafayette in a way that you haven't seen on screen.
Yes, yes. And then another fascinating character, the Chevalier Dion.
Oh, yes. One of the things I'm happiest about, proudest about, what we all did, myself, Howard, Tim, all the actors, is that we brought back into recognition people who were so invaluable to American independence, who simply have disappeared from the record, and whose contributions were immense, starting with Charles Gravier, the Comte de Vergennes, the French foreign minister, played by Thibault de Montalembert, who was Franklin's equal in these negotiations. He was also having to do an end run around his own court, which wanted nothing to do with America, but Vergennes knew that helping America would help to defeat Britain, and that was his goal. America in our story is very much like the Ukraine today. It's this small country, very few people could find on a map, if they've even heard about it, whose existence is absolutely dependent upon some superpower coming to its rescue. And the Comte de Vergennes was the person who acted for that superpower. So he's one of them. The other one is Madame Brion, who was Franklin's neighbor in Passy, his country home outside of Paris. She was one of the great pianists and harpsichordists of her generation. His son, J.C. Bach, wrote suites for her to play. She was, and she would play them in these private concerts. She was also hugely well connected to the upper echelon of French society and provided Franklin with an introduction that he otherwise never could have obtained, especially when he was snubbed by the court itself. So, and again, in Madame Brionne, her music has never been heard before. It disappeared for almost two centuries, and you're hearing it for the first time in our show.
Oh, wow. So that's her actual compositions.
Yes, that you hear. You hear it in episode one. And in episode four, she composed a march for the American victory at Saratoga, which we have just like a couple of measures of on a manuscript. And our music supervisors were able to take that and turn it into a fully orchestrated piece of music, which is just great. Similarly, Beaumarchais, Pierre Caron de Beaumarchais, the great playwright of Barbara of Seville and Marriage of Figaro, the original plays before they were turned into operas by Mozart years later, was a gunrunner. He was an enthusiastic gunrunner for the American cause, and he was due to him and the Monsieur Chaumont, Jacques Donatien, Ray de Chaumont, that the weapons and uniforms arrived in time to turn the tide for the American army at Saratoga. All of these people played hugely important roles in American independence, and they've just been, you know, they've been sidelined. Well, now they're back, and they're among the most interesting scene-stealing characters in the show. Which brings us to the Chevalier Dion, who is one of these great sort of historical mysteries. And there is, I believe now there is a French series that is going to be devoted to just the Chevalier's exploits.
Oh, cool.
The Chevalier only appears in episode three of the show, although the character is so amazingly colorful and rich that we thought about keeping them alive for future episodes. But the Chevalier, there was always this mystery, was the Chevalier, a woman, or was it a man in women's clothing? And this wasn't resolved until the autopsy at the end of the Chevalier's life. But regardless of who they were, they had fought valiantly in the Seven Years' War, what we call the French and Indian War, and had gone on sensitive missions to England on behalf of the crown, but had felt mistreated and threatened to give French state secrets to the British in retaliation, which led to them being brought back to France at the time Franklin was there, partly to distract the French public from their adulation of Franklin, which was causing real problems in the French court. Franklin was creating a sense of, oh, what if we were independent, you know, which is something they didn't need broadcast at that time. And we can certainly talk about what those repercussions were down the line, you know, just a few years down the line. So the Chevalier came back to France for a reintroduction into the French court. But the stipulation was that the Chevalier could only wear women's clothes in public. So there was just so much fascination there.
Yeah. And then the scene in the opera with Franklin, was probably fully dramatized. I don't know if there's any record of them meeting in public like that, or if that was just a great way to kind of show both the characters and Franklin's embarrassment with language, or...
You've hit on it. It is not based on a historical encounter, although it's drawn from... Franklin did attend a lot of theater. He did speak a lot. He was always adored when he was in public, but sometimes his mangling of French stopped being entertaining and just became a problem for him. And part of that scene, as Franklin explains to Temple later in the episode, is that it's not about morality in France. You know, morality was very, very fluid, but ridicule could be fatal, and Franklin could not afford to be ridiculed. It was just one more setback that he could ill afford in his effort to gain some recognition for America. So that the scene serves multiple purposes there.
Yeah, very entertaining.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask, it sounds like you really developed a friendship with the fantastic author, the late David McCullough,
yes,
who wrote John Adams. Can you tell me a little bit about that and what it was like working with him?
Oh, sure. I mean, David was... David was a dream, and we were going to do 1776 together after that, his book that was the just about the first year in the life of the Continental Army. But HBO, in that era, coming off of both John Adams, Band of Brothers, The Pacific, the expense was just too great. And the scripts are still there, collecting dust somewhere. But it wasn't going to get made, and I don't think will get made by Max now. But David was an absolute dream because he understood, partly understood, that his job as a historian, as a popular historian, was also to be a dramatist. Yeah. So he understood that I would then take his book and turn it into something that was not history, but that was not yet historical fiction. It was historical drama. So he established a couple of guidelines that were, I understand that you're always going to have to sort of shift the chronology, possibly put people in places they might not have been, but you must always be true to the character. Make sure that their reaction in the situation is real. That is, it is a reaction they would have had in this particular situation. And of course, and this was something I believed in the years even before I knew David, do not, under any circumstances, impose a 20th or 21st century set of values on the lives and thoughts of people who lived in different eras. That's not your job. Your job is to get inside their heads. So that those were invaluable lessons. And the other thing was a lesson he taught me about research. It's called marinating your head. I love that expression. Marinating your head. Read everything. Read the books that John and Abigail read, the novels. Of course, read all the letters. Learned what they cooked. Maybe don't eat it, because if you tried to eat that food, you die today with our bodies today. But you know, understand all of that. Understand, try to understand what the street smelled like and everything. And really just capture that so that when you are so immersed and you turn to writing, you've got your books and your notes in front of you, but you've ingested so much of it, it just comes out of you naturally. Stacy was very much of the same vein. Her book was incredibly rich in atmosphere. Stuff that you could just leapt off the page to me as a screenwriter. Oh, let's put this character, you know, who would be on the streets normally or in the Palais Royal. Let's make sure we have that. So there was all that detail you could draw from. And she knew that the book could never be adapted literally because there were so many dead ends. Franklin, at one point during his stay, for instance, is called upon by authorities in France to check out whether a Mesmer is real. Yes. You know, yes. And so, yeah, it's like, oh, can we get Mesmer in the show? No, it just is like it's just a detour that does nothing for the forward momentum of the narrative. There was all that stuff that we could have used that we had to jettison for one reason or another. But those are the kinds of things you look for. And so with every historian, you have a debate. With David, it was always about what happened to Charles, his middle son, who in our show, John Adams, becomes an alcoholic. And there was an estrangement between John Adams and his middle son, Charles, that, you know, when the news of Charles's death came almost simultaneously with the news that Adams had lost the election of 1800, Adams's response was, let silence reign forever over his tomb. It was really cold-blooded. Mm. But when David saw the show where there's that estrangement, he thought I'd been a little too hard on Adams. I disagreed. Stacy and I, our debate was about, you know, with Madame Brionne and Madame Helvetius, did the relationship step off the page into the boudoir? And with Madame Brionne, clearly it never did. That was a flirtatious relationship on paper. And there was never a liaison between them. But I found it hard to believe that a character like Madame Helvetius, who in many ways was the female Franklin, that they did not consummate that relationship. So without any spoilers, Stacy and I had a disagreement about that, and my perspective won out for the show.
That's something to look forward to there. Now, you've worked on lots of projects, some produced, some not produced.
Mostly not.
Is there a historical period or person that you would love to bring to the screen if you could?
It's tricky now. You know, I mean, if you'd asked me that question 5 or 10 years ago, the answer would have been different. But we're now in an era where voices that have been ignored or marginalized by the industry for its entire history, are now getting a chance to express themselves directly. So yes, there are Native American characters I would love to have written about, but now there are Aboriginal or Indigenous writers who are going to be doing those stories much better than I could do. So now it's looking at what stories I can tell that I'm allowed to tell, that I'm the right person for those stories. So, you know, I would love to be able to do, I was the supervising producer and writer for a significant chunk of a show called Into the West, which was done for TNT. That was a 12-hour show about westward expansion from the point of view of both a Native American family and a family of white colonial settlers that intersected over time. And we had real-life touchstones in the actual westward expansion movement that we built a fictional story on. But I'd love to be able to do a full-on Western at some point. I love them as a genre. I've written about them. We have a Western group that meets once a month in Santa Fe. And so that would be a period I'd love to do something with and really tell those stories that haven't been told before.
Nice, nice.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Yeah, you talked about some of the things you're most proud of with the Franklin series is bringing these characters to the screen that people aren't familiar with. Is there another moment in the series that you're most proud of?
Well, my favorite episode is the one that's coming up next. It's episode 4.
Okay.
Which is the negotiations that lead to a French-American alliance, which is the first but by far not the last step in that. And I love the way that episode came together. I love the way Tim shot it. I love the way the actors put it together. I love the twist at the end with the long-awaited appearance of John Adams in a different guise, in different interpretation. I really love those moments. And I love the moments near the end of the show, which you asked earlier about Tim's collaboration. And one of the things Tim said late in the pre-production process was, I really think that as we move into this, it should get more and more intimate and it should become like 12 Angry Men. In these negotiations, where we're trapped with these guys in a room and we're really seeing how the sausage is made. And that's what we did in the last two episodes. And like that episode of John Adams, the second episode, which is really all about the debate in Congress, in the Second Continental Congress, about whether we're going to declare independence or not, that's what those last two episodes are about. So yeah, there's a pride in the fact that this isn't a show about action. I've read things in the press about, you know, there's not enough action in the show. It's like, well, this is a show about diplomacy. Diplomacy isn't about action. It's about people in a room getting together, using their minds and using their words to get what they want, always with competing agendas, but somehow getting to that middle ground. And if you want to extrapolate this idea that people have to act, there's got to be action. No, that's why we're in the trouble we're in all around the world now. Because there's too much immediate response to things and not enough reflection, you know? And so, like what transpires in the show is not meant to be binged, which is why I'm glad we're on Apple, where aside from the first three episodes, they're releasing them week to week. You need to appreciate the episodes, maybe watch them a second time, glean all the detail you can from them so you're informed for the next show. So I think the idea of being designed for contemplation and reflection is really good, because that's what diplomacy is all about. I did work for the State Department after John Adams came out, when they were trying to put together an educational initiative. People don't know that on the top floor of the State Department in Foggy Bottom in D.C., it's actually the sixth floor, that's the offices are above it, is a place called the Diplomatic Reception Rooms, which you only see if you are a guest for some state event, whether it's private diplomacy or, say, when Joe Biden entertains the Japanese prime minister in the Franklin Dining Room. But those rooms have the largest and best collection of early colonial art anywhere in the world, including major American museums. Mm-hmm. And they're only just now getting the word out on what's in that collection to the general public. And in fact, in the last episode of the show, when Franklin and his colleagues, including John Adams, finally sit down with the British to sign the treaty that guarantees independence, the desk on which they sign in the show is the actual Treaty of Paris desk.
Oh, cool.
That Benjamin Franklin signed the treaty on. The State Department lent it to us at no expense. It came out in a crate with its own security, constantly guarded the whole time it was there, and it was on set, and it was really moving to have it there and to see the actors who knew that was the desk, what it brought to that to their performance. Again, it's one of those imperceptible things that made such a difference when we shot. But the State Department realizes the show's potential for bringing what diplomacy does as a message to people. Because we've had secretaries of defense throughout history say, give me more diplomats and I'll need fewer soldiers. Mm. And from time to time, we forget that point. And we're forgetting it all over the world now.
Yeah, and I think that's something that great historical art can be sort of a gateway to. Like the John Adams series, what Franklin is becoming. And even Hamilton the musical, getting people interested in history. One moment that I loved reading about that Lin-Manuel Miranda said, when the King of England in Hamilton is singing about John Adams, hearing that he's president, and he said, that little man, or he was referencing the John Adams series and assuming
I heard that
people knew that scene, which I just thought was so cool.
Yes. Yeah. That's a great moment in John Adams. That's so wonderfully played by Paul Giamatti and Tom Hollander as the English king. Just terrific. A great example of what you can do with two people in a room talking.
The scene, episode 2 or 3 of Franklin with Virgin and Franklin,
their first non-meeting, yes.
Yes. Yeah, so intense. And Douglas just brings a magnetism to that. And the two of them together is great to see.
Yeah. No, they're all great. This company of actors was just amazing. And the crew, which was young, and we were working with 2/3 of the amount of crew that we would normally have on a show of this size in America or England. And we got it all done. We not only got it all done, we got it done on 5-day weeks and 10-hour days. The show was so well organized by Mark Mostyn, one of our principal line producers, as well as an executive producer, by David Franco, the incredible cinematographer. And they've worked together for a long time, those two. I was often home for dinner and a movie on a production night.
Wow.
Which is just unheard of, doing a film here.
I mean, word gets out, everybody's going to want to film with these folks over there.
They will. I would easily do another show over there in a heartbeat. Absolutely. Nice.
One last thing. What do you think we can learn, really, from Benjamin Franklin in this period and from the man and his personality and actions?
Well, I think that I hope viewers go away with the sense of how fragile the American Republic was in its inception, how it easily could have gone wrong at birth had we not had this assistance from a superpower like France, but also how fragile it remains. You know, it was Franklin himself who was asked in Philadelphia after the final arguments over the Constitution, what shape it was going to take, he stepped out and a woman on the street asked him, "Dr. Franklin, what sort of government have you given us?" And Franklin said, famously, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." And I think that's the value of shows like this and of John Adams. It's to show what incredibly hard work America was in its creation, and how we need to preserve all that work. And to understand that not everybody agreed. Not everybody was, quote, on the same page. And that a lot of bargains had to be made. A lot of compromises had to be made. And look what the French gave away. You know, I mean, they essentially gave us the equivalent of over $1 trillion today to fight the revolution. And in doing so, bankrupted the treasury and set in motion all of the things that would lead to the French Revolution in 1789, which is only a scant 4 or 5 years after Franklin left to go back to America. So had Vergennes not convinced Louis XVI in the court to contribute, what would have happened? America would probably still be a British republic, and France might very well be a monarchy. So that's why you do shows like this, is to look at the alternatives.
Oh, that's fascinating. Thank you so much for your time. It was such a pleasure speaking with you, and I can't wait for the rest of the episodes to come out.
Thank you. I look forward to your thoughts.
All right.
Oh my gosh. This is definitely a person I would love to talk to even more. I mean, I could tell that you could do a whole other 5 interviews with him with the amount of knowledge
he has.
I really respect that about him, that not only is he, you know, a screenwriter and he's writing this so well, but he has such a plethora of knowledge about the historical time. And you could tell that he had a lot of admiration for the actors and all the collaborators that came together to make this project real. And I appreciated that about him. And he reminded me of you a little bit in that he loves starting with those primary sources, that he is research-based, like the organization he uses while he's researching and writing. And I felt like there was a connection between you two, whether it was said or not, of similar styles and similar respects for those primary sources.
Yeah, definitely. I could listen to him talk shop for hours.
Oh, exactly. And it's not even my shop, but it's like a shop I want to be in when he talks about it. Right. He really brings it to life, and his passion is definitely thick enough to cut with a knife. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes. And I can't wait to see the next episode, to see John Adams' character show up, to see them shoot in Louis XVI's bedroom.
Yeah. You know, how lucky and wonderful that they were able to pull that together, to be able to film in the actual places. And I'm sure that you can feel it in the walls, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure that added to the presence of the scene. But he paints such a setting, even talking about his work. And I loved listening to him talk. I feel like he might need to be at his own separate dinner party.
maybe.
Because I just, yeah, exactly.
Yes,
I
could our dinner party with all of our guests. We have a separate one with him.
Yeah, we might need our own dinner party with Kirk Ellis, because just the depths of his knowledge is clearly relevant to how he writes. And I really appreciated that.
All right, you heard us, Kirk. We're coming to Santa Fe.
We're coming. We're going to have dinner. I really did appreciate him as a person and as a writer, but also as just a historian.
Yeah. So, yeah, I would encourage everybody to check out Franklin on Apple TV Plus. They've also got some great content on there. No one's paying me to say that.
I was going to say, missed opportunities for like plugging this show, but the first 3 episodes have been riveting. And I think it's really great that it's reflected in a way that these are human beings.
Yeah.
Franklin was a human being, and that, you know, that's portrayed in all his like grossness and all his, you know, glory as well. So it's nice to see these humans being portrayed in a way that is laughable at times and can be entertained and has a lot of entertainment value as well.
And I mean, seriously, if you want more great historical dramas, you got to watch the ones that are out there to show the powers that be that there's enough interest to justify the cost of these epic, you know, multi-part series.
I mean,
they're not cheap to make.
I mean, when you hear about their filming, they're traveling the world to film this, and they're hiring on superb French actors, and just to hear the actors' level of professionalism too, of doing this enormous amount of research before even coming on set to read.
Yeah. I found out that one of the surviving glass harmonicas that we have that Franklin made was handed down from Madame Brionne.
Oh, really?
So I didn't get a chance to ask Kirk if we see the glass harmonica in the show. Have been too expensive to ship. You know?
Yeah.
That's too risky.
Talk about risk factor.
In the desk, yeah. But if we see a glass harmonica in that show, I'm just going to...
You're going to lose it.
I'm going to lose my shit.
You're just going to lose it.
Yes. If you are interested in Ben Franklin or John Adams, we've got some great episodes of the podcast for you. We did a 3-part series on Franklin in season 4. We look at his naughty reputation, his philanthropic will, and we really dig into why he and John Adams hated each other so much.
And I like how Kirk Ellis talked about, you know, grudges after the grave or grudges from the grave, how those continued even after one would pass away. So I think we detail that really well in some of our other episodes about how that came to be and the details surrounding those relationships.
If you like what you heard, please spread the word. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Consider joining our Patreon community by heading over to patreon.com/plottingthroughthepresidents. You can support our efforts there, and you get some cool bonus material, like the full uncut video version of my interview with Kirk Ellis.
That is just awesome.
Yes. So we'll be back in 2 weeks. We'll be visiting our old friend, Aaron Burr.
Oh, fun.
And his killer charm.
What?
This has been an Airwave Media podcast. Thank you for plotting along with us.
Thanks for plotting. Bye.
Was it Douglas that said, hey, I think Franklin should fart here?
Oh, yeah, he came up with that.